I have to give credit where credit is due. We had a pastoral conference call about a week and a half ago, and it was a continuing education. So they took us back to school. We do that once a quarter, and they give us ideas to help us with sermon preparation as well as things that they would like to see us cover. And one of them was a presentation from Mr. Jim Frank. So I'll put his picture up there. You saw him in the In Accord. I've given us similar sermons to this many times, but the perspective that he gave on this is different. It's something different from what I've even thought of before. It was very timely and very important as we see this world start to change, and it is. It's changing in a big way. And we in the church, as we look at the changes in the world, we naturally start thinking about the prophecies that are in the Bible about what the end times are going to be like. So again, some of this material I've covered before, but not from this perspective. So I want to go back and give you a little background. I've talked about this man before. This was William Miller. Now, if you remember this story, back in 1843, he came out with an idea that Jesus Christ was going to return somewhere between October of 1843 and October of 1844. He was an American Baptist minister, and he studied in depth Daniel chapter 8, verse 14, where it talked about 2,300 days. And he took that to mean, well, if that started when Cyprus issued his decree and that happened and this happened, then Christ is going to return in October of 1843. And you can see that there. This is actually a newspaper that he put out talking about his prophecies on what was actually going to happen. Later on, he put a flyer out, just like a simple pamphlet for people to be able to see Jesus Christ is really going to return in 1843, and he laid it all out. Here's when this happened, here's when that happened, this is this prophecy, this is that prophecy. He was kind of a mathematician, and he had it down to the day. So on the day, they all dressed in white robes, they went up on the hill to wait for Jesus Christ's return. As silly as this sounds, some of them even climbed a tree so that they would be closer to Christ when he returned so that they could get there first. And guess what? Nothing happened. So he went back and he looked again and he said, well, maybe I made some miscalculations. So he went through all the math again and he said, well, it's sometime between October 21st, 1843 and October 1st, 1843 and 1844. So on October 21st, 1844, they went back up the hill in their white and it didn't happen. I want to read this. This is from massmoments.com. It says, on October 22nd, the Millerites donned their white robes, climbed mountains and trees to speed their ascension into heaven. But when the prophecy failed, most abandoned Miller's apocryphal teaching and returned to their original way of life. This is credited as the spark behind the Seventh-day Adventist movement and several others that came out of this. But the key point here is he set a date. People expected that date. And then when it didn't happen, they lost interest in religion and just gave up. And that's one of the dangers about using prophecy that way, because you can get into this mindset of, I need to know the day. I want to know the day. When is Christ going to return? And then if it doesn't happen like you plan that out, and I'm guilty. I've got a chart on my wall at home where I did this when I was 20, we were married, 24, 25, something like that. Started when Adam was so many years old when he had Seth, and Seth was so many years when he had Enos, and I did it all, and Christ was going to return in 2019. Well, guess what? 2019 didn't happen. So I'm as guilty of this as anybody else that really enjoys doing things like this. This may look familiar to you. I don't know how many of you remember this. This was a booklet that was written by Mr. Armstrong in 1956. Called 1975 in Prophecy. How many of you remember that booklet that were around? All right, so in this, what he was talking about was, as the world is starting to turn worse and worse, and you have to remember from his perspective, World War II had just ended 11 years earlier. Europe and Germany were already being rebuilt by U.S. dollars. The Cold War in between the U.S. and the Soviet Union had started. The whole idea of nuclear weapons was on the table. We had just used a couple of them at the end of World War II, and it was looking pretty dour in the world. And so he was thinking, maybe this is it. So even though the book doesn't go through a lot of specifics, he does make this one statement, and I wanted to put this up here. This is actually a screenshot from the booklet. While modern science and industry, he says, strive to prepare us for a push-button leisure luxury world by 1975, United States Assistant Weather Chief I.R. Tannehill warns us unofficially to be ready for a drought of 1975. He goes on to say, but the indications of prophecy are that this drought will be even more devastating than he foresees. It will probably strike sooner than 1975, probably between 1965 and 1972. Now, he said that, and if you read through it, says probably, could be, might be. There's a lot of stuff in there. But when someone of authority says something like that, people take that to the bank, as did my mother. My mother told me in 1970, probably 70 or 71, I would not graduate from high school because high school graduation was 1977. Christ was going to return. I would never get married or graduate from high school, and you just had to accept that. You know, when that didn't happen in the 1972-75 time frame, there were a lot of people that left the church. They left the church over the fact that they were pinning their doctrinal livelihood on a date. And that's dangerous. That's dangerous, as we will see. Again, a lot of speculation was going on at that time. People were intent on needing to know that. Despite the fact that there's this, from Jesus Christ himself, this is a part of the Olivet prophecy, Mark chapter 13 and verse 32, of that day and hour, no one knows. And yet that's the very thing that people tried to figure out. Not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Take heed, watch and pray, for you don't know when the time is. So the Bible tells you, basically, don't do this. And that's what everybody does. It's exciting. If you're into that sort of thing, I mean, I'm an Excel spreadsheet guy, and I've got a lot of math background, and this was fun. But that can lead to a lot of disappointment. You know, the very thing that he told us not to do is the thing, and there are several groups that came out of the Worldwide Church of God that are doing that very thing now. They're making prophecies right now. Their apostle or their lead evangelist or whatever is setting dates. And some of them have set dates that I know of one particular group that's probably set 15 or 20 different dates in the last year and a half. And he keeps just putting them out there because he keeps getting them wrong. And it's starting to discourage people. We need to take this at its face value. This says that the angels don't know the date. You know, the angels that are surrounding the throne of God don't know the date. Jesus Christ himself said he didn't know the date. You remember what the disciples asked and the reason why he answered this? When are you coming back? And he said, don't know. Angels don't know. Only the Father knows. That is not something for us to worry about. And again, we need to take that at face value. Now, because of some look in the past of setting dates and dates not happening, does that then make us hesitant for me as a minister to speak about prophecy or you as a member to study it? Well, if we can't know the date, then why even look into it? And so some people, they dive deeper into the math, and some people, they say, well, I'm not going to look at it at all because everybody that's ever done this has got it wrong, and I'm not any smarter than them, so I'm just going to avoid that. Let's look at a parable of the fig tree. Now, I've put two fig trees up here, one on the left and one on the right. Those are both fig trees. The one on the left is kind of the middle of winter, and the one on the right is the start of spring. This is again in Mark 13, but a few verses earlier. It says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branches become tender and puts forth leaves, know that summer is near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that it is near at the door. Notice a couple of things that this does say and that it doesn't say. It says, when you see the leaves start, you'll know what? You will know that summer. You'll know that the season is near. Now, that's important. It doesn't say when you see the fig leaves growing, you'll know the date that you'll get your first fig. That's not what it says. And it's very specific that it's written that way. Mr. Petrie gave me Muscadine grape, and I've got a Concord grape going in the back. During the winter, it looked like that plant was completely dead. And you could go thump the vines, and they were as hard as rock. And, you know, you think, well, this is not going to grow back. But all of a sudden, when spring starts to hit, those started to get softer, and all of a sudden now it's got leaves, and we've got grapes growing. And he's saying to look at that and recognize that the season is starting. Rather than fix on a date, and this was the point of what Mr. Franks was telling us, rather than fix on a date, you look for the season. And that's important when you're studying prophecy to understand the season. We'll get into that and explain that a little more. More value in looking at the season rather than looking at the day or the hour. If we look at the season, it helps us focus on events rather than dates. When the Bible gives us prophecy, it gives us events to look for. It very rarely gives us dates to look for. You'll see, there are a few of them in there, 1260, 1290, 1335. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go read Daniel chapter 8 through 11, and you'll see those dates in there. But let's look and see what it is that we should be studying as we go through this. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24 and 25. This is something that the author of the book of Hebrews was trying to help people to understand toward the end of the age what we need to be looking at. He says, let us consider one another, verse 24, to stir up love and good works. Don't forsake the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. Now, we live in a really interesting world. We have people that watch from home on webcasts because they can't get here every Sabbath, or they live a long, long way away. And I'm glad that we have this opportunity for them to be able to see that. That's a good thing. But as the world turns darker and darker, it says you need to be stirring up one another's love. You do that through fellowship. You do that through getting together. You do that through being together. One of the things that I've always loved about this church, you can go into some churches and it's kind of quiet, and you walk in and you sit down and you listen to a 10-minute sermon, then everybody gets up and walks home, and it's not. The Church of God is a fellowshipping church of God, and that's a good thing. I love going to the feast and walking through the door and hear these hundreds and hundreds of voices that are talking. We need to do that, it says, especially as we see the day approaching. Now, I want you to notice it says the day approaching, not the date approaching. This word day can mean years, it can mean time, it can mean a period of time. But this is obviously describing the return of Jesus Christ. This is used in many scriptures to reference when Jesus Christ will return. So when will that be? Mark 13, we don't know. Even he didn't know. Now, I wonder if at the right hand of the throne of God, he knows now. I don't know. I have no idea if he knows the date or if he's waiting for the Father to say, tap him on the shoulder and say, now. I don't know. It's an interesting thought pattern, isn't it? But that doesn't stop people from doing it. There was a man named Harold Camping a few years ago. You may remember him. He was a mathematician. Not necessarily a religious person, but a mathematician. And he got interested in the same thing that William Miller did. And he sat down and he did the calculations and he figured out when Christ was going to return. And he set a date. You probably didn't see it here, but in Dallas, he had followers in Dallas that were so convinced that he was right that they painted on their cars the date that Christ was going to return. Permanent paint. I feel sorry for those people now. I don't know what they did. Maybe they went through and repainted their cars. But they would even put on there that on this date, when this happens, I might be driving along in my car and all of a sudden I'll be raptured and disappear. So don't, if you're following me on this date, don't follow too closely, you know. And they were making this big deal out of it. Billboards all over Dallas on Harold Camping. On the date, it didn't happen. So what did he do? He did the exact same thing William Miller did. He went back, tried to figure out where he was wrong, set a second date, and that didn't happen again. So what happened is a very interesting phenomenon happened. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 4, knowing this first, scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust and saying, where's the promise of his return, Harold Camping? Where's the promise of his return, William Miller? Where's the promise of, the promise of his return? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. And so in Dallas, this is one of my favorite pictures that I've ever seen in the newspaper. We had guys on the day that Harold Camping failed prophecy were making fun of him. They went out dressed like they were John the Baptist and in robes with, you know, Moe's hair and all that, carrying signs saying, false alarm, sorry, my bad. And we had people that went around on park benches and in like train station and metro stations, and they would take like a business suit and they would arrange it like where they were sitting with their leg crossed and their arm up on the back, but it was just a suit, like they had been raptured and their clothes were left. One guy even left a cell phone there. It's like he dropped his cell phone. Scoffers were happening at that time because of the fact that a date was set and people were so behind that. Now, can you imagine the people, again, that painted their cars and were really into this, putting billboards up? What did they do after this failed prophecy was over? Well, they slunk into the background. But this isn't just outside the church. This can be inside the church as well. If we get to the place where we look at a date rather than the season, we can lose confidence in the teachings of the church. And again, that did happen in the 70s. There was, we call it a falling away, but there were people that said in 1974, there were ministers and members that left and said, yeah, we're done. We're not going to be doing this anymore. In fact, it actually led, by the time the 90s came, there was one sermon, and I heard this sermon, I listened to it, I blocked his name so that you can't see it, but in 1990, on June the 2nd, there was a tape that was sent out to be played in all the churches, and it was called Fun with Prophecy. And what it was a minister who was making fun of us for having tried to set dates in the past. And so what he did was he said, now we're going to go look at a prophecy and we're going to see, you know, how long it is from the time, you know, and I don't remember exactly what he said, but, you know, you plant a tree until you get its first fruit and you can mathematically say blah, 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 blah. And he was actually making fun of the fact that we looked so much at prophecy. The gist of this sermon was focus on Christian living and ignore prophecy because you can't understand it anyway. I blocked this out so that you can't see it all, but this was in our magazine, the Plain Truth Magazine. Let me see if I've got a date here. Nineteen ninety-three, Plain Truth. It was an article written entitled Prediction Addiction, and it was making fun of the fact that people were looking at and trying to set dates when studying prophecy in that way was useless. And yet, we are instructed through the Bible to look at prophecy. Jesus Christ himself in the Olivet Prophecy said, watch. Watch what? What is it that we're supposed to be watching? And that's the topic of what we're going to talk about today. How can we use prophecy wisely in the church? Well, part of it is my job. A part of it is my job. I need to be making sure that you're fed a good diet. A pastor, if you think about a pastor out on the field that has sheep, he has to provide good meadows and good water for his sheep to be able to eat. But the second thing a pastor has to do is to make sure that he protects the church. So my job is to make sure that you're fed, and my job is to make sure that you are protected. That part is my job. I have to pick topics that wisely show what the Bible says. I have to label speculation as speculation. Have you heard me say on a number of occasions, this is my opinion, this is speculation, don't call Mr. Horchek? I do that because I want people to know there are times when I'm speculating, and that's outside of what you can prove in the Bible. It's my opinion and my thoughts. But a part of it is your responsibility, and I say our responsibility. I provide sermons So does Dr. Avent and Mr. Lettier and others that are giving sermonettes and sermons. We're doing that to help feed you. But you shouldn't just be eating the diet that you're fed at church. You need to be studying. You need to be praying. You need to be looking at things yourself, watching the news. You need to be prepared for what's happening. I want to show you a list that I have here. It's hard to see on the right, but I have a list of every sermon that I've ever given in. And again, I'm an Excel spreadsheet freak. I recognize that. That's just me. I have the date that I gave it, and then I have a category. Is it prophecy? Is it Bible study? Is it Christian living? So I did a pivot table to see what percentage of times am I giving sermons on various topics, and you can see them there. 10% is Bible study. If I go through and talk about the book of Ruth or the book of Esther, something like that, it's a Bible study. Christian living, if I talk about the fruits of the Spirit, those, you know, I went through the fruits of the Spirit, Christian living. Doctrine, if I talk about the Sabbath or the holy days or what we think about God or the Trinity or anything like that, that's doctrine. Marriage and the family, I've only done 2%. I actually was surprised when I looked at this. It's just not something that I talk about very much. Am I giving you a proper diet? We'll talk about that in a moment. Maybe there's more to that than I need to do. The other, there's a couple of categories where I gave it, like on Foundation Outreach International. I gave a sermon on that. Overcoming and repentance, that tends to happen around the spring holy days when we spend a lot of time talking about that. Prophecy and world events, 15%. So this will fall into that category. When I go put this in my spreadsheet, I'll list this as prophecy. Sabbaths and festivals. So I've given 250 sermons. This July 30-something will be our 10-year anniversary of being here. So we will have given by that time 255, 257, something like that, sermons. So I have a question for you as we go through this. At one time, I heard a minister say that since one-third of the Bible is prophecy, one-third of our sermons should be about prophecy. Is that true or is that not true? I don't know. But I will say this, even though we have 15% of the sermons from my sermons that are on prophecy, the Sabbaths and the festivals, a lot of the festivals deal with prophetic events, Feast of Trumpets, others, you know. So that figure probably is higher than 15%. But I would like to ask you a question. I have an assignment for all of you. I have two things. I want an email. I did this in Laurel, and I got one email back, so I'm disappointed. Hopefully you guys will do better. I want an email back, and I want there to be two things in it. Number one, do you think that the ministry in the New Orleans Covington Church is feeding you adequately? Do you think you're being spiritually fed? That is a yes or no question. Second question is, what topics would you like for us to cover that we're not covering? I see things. I get ideas from headquarters on here's the types of topics that we think you guys should be covering based on what's happening in the world, et cetera. And we tend to give those based on the things that are of interest to us. You know, Dr. Avent and Mr. Lettier, Mr. Sinan now giving sermons, we all come at this from our perspective. One of the reasons why they used to move ministers around every 7 years was so that you'd get a varied diet. You know, one minute you talk about tools. One minister might be sandpaper. You know, he's smoothing the edges. Another might be a hammer. You ever had a hammer? Brethren! Right? We all have different personalities. You've got stuck with me, and you're going to be stuck with me for a while. That's just a part of it. So am I feeding you well? Is there sermon topics that you would like to hear? I want an email. Teenagers, preteens, I want an email. Young adults, are you being fed properly, and what topics would you like to see that we haven't done? Now, that's my responsibility to be able to feed you. How about you? Are you feeding yourself? 2 Thessalonians chapter 5. I want to read through this. Starting in verse 1, this is six verses along, but it talks a lot about what is going to be happening as we approach the end of the age. It says, "But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I," and I'm going to insert myself in there, "I as the pastor," Dr. Avent or Mr. Lettier or Mr. Sinan, you don't have a need for us to just be the only ones that give you this information. that we need to write to you. Verse 2, for you yourselves know perfectly well that the day of the Lord, the return of Jesus Christ, it says in Scripture, it says in prophecy, is going to come as a thief in the night. People are going to say peace and safety, but sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. So what's the answer? So you, brethren, this is your responsibility. It is my responsibility, not only as a pastor, but as an individual studying the Bible. Don't be in darkness so that this day should overtake you as a thief. To understand prophecy is important. To set a date can be misleading. So how are we going to do that? We'll get into that in just a moment. You are, verse 5, the sons of light and the sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but watch and be sober. We have to watch the things that are going on in this world. Do we focus, now I'm talking about you individually, but I say we, do we focus on prophecy too much? I think there are some people that do. There are some people, and in my 20s, that was the only thing I ever studied was prophecy. In fact, when I started giving sermonettes, and this was back in Dallas, Mr. Horchek had to pull me aside one day and say, you have given your last prophetic sermon or sermonette. Everything from now on is Christian living. And I thought I was going to have a heart attack because I didn't know how to do that. And I think in his mind, he knew that my study, as well as my helping out the people in the Dallas congregation, was unbalanced. And it was. So I started giving Christian living sermons, and that was hard for me. And yet, there we 30-something percent, a third of my sermons now are on Christian living. I'm glad that he did that. I'm glad that he forced that on me. It helped me. Do you force yourself to study a varied diet? Think about your physical diet. Are you a paleo, meat eater, or do you have a varied diet? Do you enjoy perhaps reading about personal growth and Christian living? Maybe that's the thing that you like. You like reading articles on how to be a better person or how to be a better Christian. That's important too. That's a part of a valuable diet. But if you do that to the exclusion of reading about prophecy, then you're not going to be watching as the day approaches. We've got to be doing that as well. You need to be becoming a better person, but you also need to be watching world events. You need to have a balanced diet. Is your personal spiritual diet varied? Are you afraid of prophecy? Some people don't like reading prophecies because guess what? There are things in those prophecies that talk about a very dark time coming, and it scares people. So they may avoid reading about the prophecies in the Bible because it's frightening to read, and yet we need to be prepared. So Mr. Franks then gave 7 points. Now, if you've been in the church a long time, you know that all the old-time ministers, all sermons, had, if they had points, they had to have 7. And he kind of chuckled about that. He said, there's probably 10 or 12 or 15 if you want to come up with it, but here's my big 7, he said. So we're going to go through this list today, and what he was doing is he was giving it to the pastors so that we would give an appropriate prophetic diet to the church. I'd like to turn that around and say, as you study your personal Bible study, how do you approach prophecy? These points are valid for me to help you, but they're also valid for you to be helping yourself. So let's go through these today and see if these can keep us pointed in the right direction, looking at the season rather than the dates. Here's the first one. Now, there are 7 of them. The first 2 are going to take a long time. And by the time I get to point 3, you're going to say, he's still got 5 more to go. Now, the last ones are going to go real quick. The first 2 are going to take a while. The first thing that we should be looking for as a season, not as a date, as the end of the age approaches, there's going to be an explosion in knowledge. Daniel chapter 12, verse 4. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal up the book until the time of the end, for many will run to and fro, and knowledge will be increased. Now, how do you start that? How do you understand that? I'm going to throw some percentages and some figures at you because I like that. That's how I think. This isn't necessarily for you to write down in your notes unless you're a geek like I am and you like this sort of thing. But I found this fascinating when I went. He just mentioned this as passing, and then I went through and actually did Let's pick a starting point. Let's say that Adam and Eve started around 4,000 BC, and we're at 2023, so we've roughly covered 6,000 years of human history. So let's look at these pictures up here. You see the printing press. From roughly 4,000 BC until 1436 AD, there was no printing press. So 5,436 years of the 6,000 years, there was no printing press. 90.6% of humanity never saw a printed page. How did they get knowledge? There were scrolls that were handwritten. The ministry had them. You know, the priests, the Catholic priests or Lutheran priests or whatever, the rabbis from back in the day, they had them. But as Mr. Frank said, a lot of people from time immemorial couldn't read. They would go to services and the minister would read to them. They'd go to synagogue, the minister, the rabbi would read to them. And they were the ones that had a handwritten copy of a book. Can you imagine how hard that would be to say, you know what, I'd like to have my own copy of the Bible, and you'd have to hire a scribe who would take years to be able to put that together at an enormous cost. So 90.6% of human history didn't have access to a printed Bible. The radio is the next one. I've got old pictures here for a reason. Radios don't look like that now. In fact, most of you probably don't even have a radio or use it. But that was a big deal. Radio was available to the public in the late 1920s. So from 4,000 BC to 1920, 98.8% of human history did not have a radio. They didn't have a way to broadcast, right? 1934, 60% of U.S. households had radios. And for those of you that are as old as me, we can remember having a radio that was prominent in the living room of our house. And my parents would listen to Amos and Andy and Lone Ranger and all of these programs that were on radio. 1934, in January, was when the World Tomorrow broadcast began, one of the first religious programs, and that was a way to get knowledge out. I talked with people that were back in, that listened to the program back in the day that were truckers, and they could travel across the United States, and every half an hour they could turn to a different station and get the same program and hear it over and over and over and over again every night. We were blanketing that. Television, here's an old television. I will say this, I was deprived as a child. We only had black and white. And I did not know until I was in college that half of the Wizard of Oz movie was in color. I did not know because we had a black and white television. So the first part, if you don't know anything about that movie, the first part of it's in black and white. And then when Dorothy goes over the rainbow, then you have a yellow brick road. And it actually was yellow. I didn't know that. To this day, I'm stunted. So we have television that's come in now. By 1960, 45.7 million homes in the United States had television. The World Tomorrow television program started in 1955. Now we have the internet, which is basically replacing everything. The printing press, the radio, the television, things are now going to the internet. January 1st, 1983 is credited as the birth of the internet. From 4,000 BC to 1983, 99.72% of humanity did not have access to something like the internet to be able to get information. Knowledge is increasing at a rapid rate right now. It's estimated that 4.9 billion active users, or 62% of the population, have it right now. By 2030, it is estimated that 90% will have the internet. Now, some of you are going to laugh at this, but I'm going to tell you a story. It is estimated by 2050 that your screens will be replaced with eye implants. And these will be a thing of the past because you'll have implanted in your eye the ability to pull up. You can say, I'm being somewhat facetious here, Siri, let me see what the Wall Street Journal is saying, and it will show up in your eye. Now, you may think, oh, that's never going to happen. Let me tell you a story. It's 1989, I'm teaching at Ambassador College, and I played them an AT&T video. And the video showed the future of telecommunications. Now, at the time, you know, they were rotary dial telephones, not to push, you know, and you had one in your home. It might have been a wall-hanging unit that you had to pull the receiver out and put it up to your ear and talk into the phone. That was kind of in people's heads. This video said there's going to come a time, and they showed a boy riding a bicycle, and in their version, he had a necklace with a little pendant or something on it. I don't know what you would call it. And then you see on the split screen, he's riding his bike, and you see his mother, and she's got a necklace with a pendant on it. And her hands are busy, so she's saying, Johnny, dinner's in 20 minutes. And he's on his bike. He says, okay, Mom, I'll be home. And then the person comes on from the AT&T video and says, there's going to come a time where we won't have home phones, that everybody will carry their phone with them. And when we showed that video, my entire class started to laugh in derision. That'll never happen. Guess what? How many of you do not have home phones anymore? That's the percentage is getting higher. We don't. Cut the cord. Don't have one. All we have is a mobile phone. So by 2050, will you have implants in your eye? Who knows? Is that explosion in knowledge a good thing? Well, yes, if you're talking about spreading the gospel of the truth. There's a lot of information out there now. You remember Mr. Armstrong had to go to the Portland Library to look stuff up about whether the Sabbath was Saturday or Sunday, and he had to drive 2 hours. All that information is there on your iPad or your Android tablet or whatever it is that you may have. It's all there. Yes, so that explosion is a good thing. But along with that, there are some dangers. I actually want to show you a couple. This is an article that came out in Fox News. Google had a man who was, they call him the godfather of AI. His name is Jeffrey Hinton. He quit Google because he's so afraid of where AI is going that, Elon Musk and others have started talking about how dangerous AI is. I think of the movie Terminator when it came out, and we all laughed at that. Well, a lot of people are now getting a little bit more serious about it. Give you some examples. We have things now called deepfakes, where you can take like you see this guy, the original picture on the left, and then he says, well, I want to show my friends who I am on the internet. So you can put your picture into a deepfake app, and it will turn you into whoever you want. In this case, he said, well, I want to look like Tom Cruise. So he has that. We also have the ability to show, and I actually will show you one in a moment, videos that are made that are fake, but they look like they're real. And again, I'll show you one. Down in the lower right-hand corner, this is the president of the Ukraine. Russia came out with a video, and I was going to play this, but it's in Russian, so none of you are going to understand it. But he basically said in this video, all of our soldiers in the Ukraine, we've lost the war, lay down your arms, we're surrendering, and it was all fake. And it was blasted out on the airwaves over Ukraine by Russian television, to try and get their people, to get the Ukrainians to give up on the war. Total fake. Now, I'm going to show you one here. How do they do this? So deep fake videos, they go and they look at, what they do is they take the search engine, this AI engine, they say, go out and find a personality. In this case, it could be a Barack Obama or a Donald Trump or anybody. Go out and find all the videos that you can and take all these snapshots from looking this way, looking this way, and looking this way, and you kind of develop this when he talks, how does he move his mouth, and AI learns all that. They analyze the speech pattern, and they decide, oh, well, here's how he speaks, and here's how his voice works, and then they can create, all they have to do is type in, here's what we want the person to say, and they can create a video. This is, what I'm going to show you now, is a deep fake video that is completely and utterly false. This is made up.
I am not Morgan Freeman, and what you see is not real. Well, at least in contemporary terms, it is not. What if I were to tell you that I am not even a human being? Would you believe me? What is your perception of reality? Is it the ability to capture, process, and make sense of the information our senses receive? If you can see, hear, taste, or smell something, Does that make it real? Or is it simply the ability to feel? I would like to welcome you to the era of synthetic reality. Now, what do you see?
That was a complete and total fake. He had nothing to do with that. He knew about it ahead of time, and he allowed them to use his image, but that was 100% computer generated. All somebody did was wrote a text that worked for this company and went out on the internet and looked at video and pictures of him and listened to his voice and analyzed it, and they completely created that. Now, if you look at that really, really closely, you can see that it's a little off. But they're getting better and better and better at that. What does that mean for the future of us watching as knowledge is exploding? Get into that a little while later on another point. So let's go ahead and go forward into point number two. This is all out of the same scripture, Daniel 12, verse 4. There will be advancements in transportation. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal up the book until the end time. What are the two things that Daniel was told would be happening that we should watch for, to watch for the seasons? Not only would knowledge be increasing, but people would run to and fro. You know, if you think back, even into the 1920s and 30s and 40s, if you wanted to go to Europe, the only way to get there was by boat. And it would take, you know, it might take weeks to be able to get overseas. If you wanted to go somewhere by land, like the Apostle Paul did, it was walking, donkey, camel, or if you were in the military, horses. But horses were a rare breed. Can you imagine how fast? I have to laugh when it talked about people trying to escape a coming army, and it says they got on their donkey and rode off. You could almost run faster than that. But anyway, that was the quick getaway, was to get on your donkey. Sorry, I shouldn't have done that. May the 10th, 1869, the Golden Spike Railroad. So we now have a cross-country railroad system. 97.8% of human history did not have a transcontinental railroad system. Railroad is a relatively new invention. Transportation. 1886, Carl Benz applied for a patent. And you see his first automobile there. The first Benz. 98.1% of humanity did not have motorized transportation. The Wright brothers' first flight was in 1903. 98.4% of human history did not have air travel. 1952, the first jet aircraft was in commercial aviation. 99.2% of humanity did not have air travel. They're now working on new advancements to reduce the sonic boom noise so that we can get transonic again. We have SSTs, they're in the past, but they were noisy. We're trying to get it now to where we can have that to where we do not have that problem. Not to mention some other things, Tesla's now doing a test on underground maglev trains that can go 600-700 miles an hour, get you from one place to another real quick. Advancements in transportation are coming. The next five are going to go a lot faster, trust me. You're already looking at your watches, I can see you. Let's go through the next ones. The daily sacrifices will end. Daniel chapter 12, verse 11. From the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Okay, now we have a specific. From the time the sacrifices in the Holy Land are taken away, we've got 12,090 days before the return of Christ. But let me ask you a question. When are they going to be taken away? Do you have a date? I don't. When are they going to start? Do you have a date? I don't. They're trying every year. In fact, this is a picture. If you remember the video that I sent of Emily and I, this is from the top of the Mount of Olives. You can see the Temple Mount in the background. Every year, ultra-Orthodox Jews find a place to sacrifice an animal on the Passover. They go to the Knesset, which is their version of the Senate, and say, we would like to sacrifice this animal on the Temple Mount to start sacrifices again. And every year, the Knesset says no. So they go find a place and they sacrifice an animal, but it's not really started. There isn't a law that says, yes, you conservative Jews can now start your daily sacrifice again. That has to start before it can stop. We don't know when that's going to be, but we watch for the season. We watch for when these things happen. There are groups out there now. They've got the menorahs. They've got the cornerstone for a third temple, which you don't have to have, by the way, for the return of Christ, even though there are conservative Jews that think they do. We have all of this out there that is happening right now in the ultra-Orthodox community. But they have to start before they can be stopped. Once they start, how long do we have before they stop? We don't have that knowledge either. So we might look at this and say, the sacrifices have started. And they try and come up with a date. Well, sorry, the sacrifices could last for a day or they could last for 50 years before they finally get taken away. We don't have that knowledge. But what we do have is what to look for. They'll start, and then at some point in time, they're going to stop. That's finding the season. Point number four. There will be a great tribulation to come. Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. For then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. When I read this scripture, I think about what happened in 1945 when the two atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I look back at that and I think, you know, I wasn't alive then. I wasn't born until 1958. But I would imagine, as I read through the history books, that the world held its collective breath for a period of time and said, is this it? Is this the end? Well, a lot of things are happening right now that are bringing that back into the forefront. Russia has now put nuclear-tipped warheads in Belarus and has warned if the United States gets further involved in the war with Ukraine, they will launch nuclear weapons into Belarus. That's active. Are you reading that in the papers? Are you looking at the signs of the seasons as they're happening? This is starting to heat up. Netanyahu came out with an article in the Jerusalem Post saying that a nuclear Iran could blackmail any U.S. city they want. In fact, it also said in another article in the Jerusalem Post that Iran now has enough nuclear material to make 5 bombs. And the people that have control of that are the people that say that they want Israel to be wiped off the map. We know that the time is coming when a king of the south is going to push against the Holy Land and against the king of the north, and the king of the north is going to come down and a great war is going to happen. The signs of the season are there. Are we watching? Again, not to look at an event, one, but to look at the season. Point five, mass communication, streaming video to the entire world. Now, this may seem really silly to us today, but if you remember back, and of course, I say if you remember, 90% of you won't, including me. When my father was growing up, the only way to find out what was happening in World War I and even in World War II was to go to the movie theater, and before the movie played, they would have a newsreel. And I don't know if you've ever seen them. The correspondents have this certain type of voice. And in other news, we have information coming out from Europe on the bombing of London. And they would show bombs bursting and all of that. That was how you found out about what was happening. And that was like something that happened in the last month or so. Now we have the ability through mass communication. You see these pictures of these Starlink satellites that are being sent out where people can now get information live. How does that happen? Let's actually read about that. Some of you may not realize this prophecy, but Revelation 11, verse 7, this is talking about the two witnesses. When they finish their testimony, after 3.5 years, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them and overcome them and kill them. So the two witnesses that will be doing God's work will die. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom in Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. So they will be killed in Jerusalem. Then those from the peoples, tribes, tongues, and nations will see their dead bodies 3.5 days. How will people in other nations see the bodies of these dead men or women, whoever they are, laying on the street. This is communication that will be live streamed to the world. That's not something that we actually can do right now, although we're a whole lot closer to it. But as the technology is increasing, they're going to be able to do this. But I also want to talk about what it says in verse 10. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice because these two prophets were killed. Why? And they will make merry and send gifts to one another because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. Now, I want to go back to this deepfake video that I saw. Could it be, this is speculation, I'm labeling it as speculation, everybody listen to me, this is not a doctrine from the church. What's going to cause the people of the world to celebrate the fact that God's true two prophets, why they will be celebrating the fact that they got killed? We know that the prophecies say that these two witnesses will be able to cause it to not rain or cause fire to come down from heaven in the days of their prophecies. I wouldn't be surprised that someone could create a video, someone from the other side, the beast power or the false prophet, to be able to create a video that shows these guys fake saying, we're going to destroy the world if you don't bow down and worship us or whatever. And that isn't what they said at all. But because of whatever is being fed them, they're going to be happy at the fact that these two prophets of God died. Not only with mass communication, but streaming video that the entire world can see. That's coming. That's something that we are seeing every time SpaceX launches 50 more satellites. It gets close, Starlink satellites, it gets closer and closer to the entire world to be able to live stream. We're not there yet, but it's happening. Six, false religion in the Holy Roman Empire. This is five sermons, and all I'm going to do is just say, reread Revelation chapter 17, and if you haven't read it in a while, reread our book of Revelation, The Storm Before the Calm, because this talks about what will happen. There is a false religion that is going to form. There is a 10-nation Europe, European kingdom that's going to start with a beast power, and they're going to get together. Here's an example of looking at the seasons. This was in the Jerusalem Post just a couple of days ago. The Pope in Hungary urged Europe to unite to end the war next door. So the Pope is looking at the United States and saying, they're not doing anything. So Europe, if you want to stop Russian aggression, you need to get together and you need to reform as the Holy Roman Empire under the auspices of the Pope, of course, and be ready to be able to defend the rest of Europe against the aggression from Russia. Remember what happened in World War II? Remember Hitler said, if you just give us the Rhineland, we'll be fine, and that's it. And I think it was Chamberlain said, you know, guys, we peace in our time. All we have to do is just ignore the fact that he's taking over this section. And then what happened? A little while later, it was Poland and then Austria. And they're looking at this and saying, we can't let that happen. There will come a time when Europe will form under the auspices of the Holy Roman Empire. That is coming. And it's something that we need to be watching. And then finally, the seventh one. And for all the rest of these, I've put a picture. But I didn't want to picture moral depravity. I didn't want to have anyone's eyes bleed at something that was going on, so there's no picture for this. But 2 Timothy 3 talks about what it's going to be like right before the return of Christ. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. For people, says men, but people will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, without self-control. Without self-control. I gave a whole sermon on that just recently. Just think of all the shootings that are happening where someone says in their mind, I'm going to go get a couple AR-15s and 1,500 rounds of ammunition, and I'm going to go kill as many people as I can, even though I know it's going to end in my death. People don't have self-control anymore. This is just where we are headed. Traitors, headstrong, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. So much of Christianity is being taken out of schools, etc. now. That is a seasonal thing. We should be able to look at that and see that. That's what's going to happen in the last days. All right, let's bring this to a conclusion. As these things develop, we in the ministry should be alerting you. I go out to Fox, ABC, CBS, CNN, BBC, Jerusalem Post every day. That's every morning I go out and I search that. And Reuters, sorry, I left that out. My job is to see these things and present them to you. But your job is also to be watching, as I need to be seeing what is going on. Consider again the parable of the fig tree. When you see the leaves start to come out, you know the summer's near. But guess what happened to my grapevines the other day? I had grapes that were growing, I had leaves that were growing, and then what happened? We had a freeze, and I lost everything. That can happen in the world, too. We can see things happening, and we think, oh, this is it. We look at an event and say, this happened, that's it. And then a freeze can happen, and it kind of regresses again. Stop looking at the date, stop looking at the event, and look at this season. The season is heading in that direction. Seasonal changes happen. They sometimes happen slowly. Again, rather than looking at one thing, we look at a series of things developing over the course of months, perhaps even years. So, brethren, are we watching? Are we praying? Are we learning? Are we looking for when summertime is coming? We can see it on the horizon. When is it going to happen? Are we being prepared? Will we understand the times in which we live? If we do that, if we learn to recognize the season as it approaches, then we will be prepared, as Jesus Christ warned us, to be ready for the eventual return of the Son of God.